Support for Aspen Public Radio comes from Balcom & Green PC, a full-service law firm with offices in Glenwood Springs, Aspen, and Basalt, providing advice and solutions for their clients' legal needs throughout Western Colorado for more than 60 years. Learn more at balcomgreen.com.
Good afternoon from Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bechtesh. This is Valley Roundup. Joining me today are David Krause, editor of the Aspen Times. Hi, David.
Hello.
Thanks for coming in. Curtis Wackerly, editor of the Aspen Daily News. Hi, Curtis.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
And Cindy Hirschfeld, editor of the Aspen Sojourner Magazine. Cindy, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
This week, the city of Aspen will build new offices. It's up to the public to decide where. A look into the life in the valley for many undocumented workers, and an investigation into out-of-state legal troubles of a school administrator continues. Those stories and more coming up on Aspen Public Radio. All right, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but we do have official ballot language for that city office vote. The council decided on that this week, and the options are if the offices should be built at 517 East Hopkins or 427 Rio Grande Place. And it involved also making a settlement with people who were against that building at Rio Grande Place. Curtis, why did there have to be a settlement involved in a ballot issue?
So when the council approved that building last year in April of 2017, they were sued by some citizens who wanted a public vote on that project. And the city felt that it wasn't subject to a referendum. They thought that you couldn't actually have a public vote on it. These guys went out and got signatures. Turns out they came up short on their signatures. It's been a really sort of complicated legal battle, but it ultimately came down to them not having enough signatures. The case is still pending. There's another case. You know, there's all sorts of litigation around this. And the council ultimately decided to put it on the ballot, not an up or down vote on the project these guys were opposed to, which is what they wanted at first, but a choice between two options. Because in the midst of all this, the city kind of came up with a plan B where they negotiated a deal with Mark Hunt, the developer who owns a bunch of buildings downtown and is in the process of redeveloping them, to buy some office space from him in two of his buildings that are across Hopkins Avenue from the existing City Hall. So, you know, there's a lot of appeal to having it all be being together there, kind of right across the street from one another, instead of building on this site that's, you know, basically two blocks away. You know, there's pros and cons to both options. You know, by doing this, you know, by putting it on the ballot, the council settled the lawsuit. They were able to get right. The plaintiffs to agree that, okay, you know, this is close enough to what we wanted. So the lawsuit will most likely go away after the vote.
It's funny to me that they didn't just put the ballot measure up, lawsuit or not, that they were like dangled mm-hmm. this carrot out. And like, mm-hmm. would they literally not have let the public vote if the lawsuit had been settled?
I think they might have. I think there's a fair amount, you know, like I said, there's a lot of pros and cons to both options. And the council may have said, well, let's just see what the public wants anyway, even if it wasn't for the lawsuit settlement. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, if you could read the tea leaves, I think there's still a lot of support on council for the, you know, for the Galena option, which yeah. is building on the city's own land two blocks away. You know, so maybe that would have enough support without going to a vote.
Okay. There's something to be said for passing the buck to the public, right? Like, whatever gets built now, either way, the city gets offices.
The public owns it, yeah.
Right. And I'm curious what you all think. This decision is being made by a very small electorate. It's only City of Aspen voters who are going to decide where these new offices go.
And it's a midterm, so traditionally there aren't, you know, turnout for a midterm is not as much. However, as we, Curtis and I, were talking with John over at Grassroots, there's a lot on this midterm, you know.
Yeah.
And so I think you might see a better turnout than most years. Because of that, with all the mill levies that are out there now, with this and with the idea of changing the voting day for municipal elections. I think that will help this cause to get more people out there. But to Curtis's point, I question if they wouldn't have had an either or, would they have put it on the ballot, because they don't, you know, now they know they're going to get their city
exactly.
building either
right.
way. So, right. Which is, I think, the biggest part of the whole,
right.
The idea of getting that place on Hopkins.
And that was their main argument, you know, that when they were talking about how they didn't want to put it on the ballot, you had the city manager get up in a public meeting and say, do not put this on the ballot. Public buildings always lose. The public is never going to go for it. There's a now sort of infamous line that's been quoted over and over again where he said, you know, basically mandatory colonoscopies and new government buildings are right up there
on
the public's the public's appetite for things they want. So don't put this on the ballot.
They've tried so hard not to put it on the ballot. One thing they could have done was finance the Rio Grande option. It would have been with a bond that the public would have had to approve. Mm-hmm. They decided not to do that, which kind of cost them in some of the rates and going
right,
directly
and
into
move,
their own.
And having to move all this money around from various departments to pay for it instead of just going out and, you know, getting bonds for it.
And now here we go with the public vote. There right. is another thing on the ballot. I don't know if either one of you are watching this, which would say these bond measures don't have to go to the public anymore. Which I wonder if that is a direct reaction to, I wish we could have funded our city offices.
It's only certain types of bonds. It's not all bonds. I'm not totally up on all the details of that, but my understanding is that general obligation bonds that are tied to taxes are still subject to voter approval.
Right.
One thing I wondered about this, I haven't read anything in the news relating this situation to the lawsuit that was either threatened or brought against the city several years ago and that resulted in the art museum being where it is. Is there any relation between the two or any relation to the city's reaction to this?
Only in that it's this like emerging trend that we have government by lawsuit.
Fear of lawsuit.
Yeah, just that lawsuits are a very powerful tool of public policy these days, much to the chagrin of lots of people. And I think you heard this from some folks in the public that talking about whether or not we should do this deal with Hunt for the Hopkins Avenue space, that they really didn't have the taste for that because it's like they're being backed into this because of a lawsuit. And look at how that's what happened with the Aspen Art Museum. We got that building because of a lawsuit, and you know, we don't want to do government this way.
Right. The other thing that I don't think is made that clear is that we are talking a teardown of at least one of those buildings at Hopkins and Galena. We're not talking about just using a space that's there. Right. It's still new construction.
Right. Well, but the argument there is that it's going to be torn. It's already an approved project to tear that building down and rebuild a new building. So the thinking there is that's going to happen anyway. So you can move the city offices project into that building instead of having to build.
Okay.
Then, you know, the argument that you're hearing from some people is that it takes a new construction project off the table because you're not building at the Galena site. But of course,
this is what I want to talk about next. Perfect.
This is segueing into if we're not going to build city offices on the Galena site, well, hey, that makes that site available to build all sorts of other potential concepts that are flying around out there. So I think I said this before on this program, like this whole notion of let's put city offices at Hopkins because that stops a construction project from happening is super dubious because that presupposes that no one's ever going to build on that land. And that's already pretty much gone out the window with
right.
all the talk about
it. Yeah, I thought one of the arguments for having it not on Galena Plaza was to preserve that as open space and preserve viewplanes, et cetera.
So right. that's what I don't get about. And so now Mark Hunt is eyeing that and offering to the city, hey, I can make you an extended, beautiful park plus a convention center, which we don't have. Mm-hmm. So let's get one of those in here. But mm-hmm. how is a convention center more appealing? I mean, it's still a building, right? In the same location that we were talking about for city mm-hmm. offices and used for tourists, not locals, getting stuff done, right. you know, like not used as much. How is that more
yeah.
appealing?
Well, so Mark has been shopping this this kind of concept around. He had some architects do some drawings that showed one thing that is kind of nice about what he was proposing is it does expand the park. You take Rio Grande Park and you basically build over the tunnel the roadway under, build the park over it. It kind of there's green space going up that hill to what's now Galena Plaza. And so you basically have a bigger park and then a smaller building off on the west that is a convention center. Now, yeah, we can debate the merits of convention center versus offices. Mm-hmm. And do we need a convention center? Is that something we want? You know, it'd go great with the bigger airport.
Curtis, you were just laying down the segues today. Also, this week, We learned about what type of airplanes could come into the Aspen Airport with the new runway design that's coming. And it seems like the people who are most scared of what might happen at the airport, that will have more noise, that will have these huge jets, it seems like we might even have a trial run, but actually the new planes that are coming might be quieter and might mean less flights. Like, this might be exactly what people who are worried about noise would want.
Well, there's, I think, some technology in the aviation industry that people aren't really putting their heads around as much, and the fact that these older planes are phasing out, and this is the new way that aviation is headed. And so do people want 737s coming in here? No, the weight ratios and the takeoffs and all that, there's different, you know, different setups for these planes. But the idea that you can have them coming in at all is what people are kind of, you know, freaking out about. But there are some planes that are going to come in here, some newer technology planes that are going to, as you mentioned, address that issue. And the test run, I think, is interesting.
Who's going to pay for that? It's not going
to
be cheap.
Who wants to volunteer?
Yeah. Well, I just think, you know, that's an interesting concept.
I'll ride on the airplane. I'll go to Boston direct from Aspen. I mean, they're saying some of these flights can go nonstop to the East Coast.
Right, right. And that's where, you know, I think people who come here from the East Coast, you know, you saw it last year. You see it anytime there's a powder day or whatever. They lose 2 or 3 days getting here because they're stuck in Chicago or they're stuck in Atlanta or whatever, and they want that more direct access like you do have down to Dallas and San Francisco and L.A. and all those one-stop, you know, or non-stop, you know, jumps.
The direct flights are definitely nice. I will say that. I guess the question is, if the CS-100, the plane they're talking about, can hold 120 people, the current planes hold about 70.
Right.
You know, if we're talking 737s, you're doubling the capacity on each plane. What does that mean for the overall carrying capacity of the Valley? You know, is that just going to put our tourism industry on steroids, which gives people a lot of concern, especially, you know, considering how busy things are now?
Right, but you still consider, I mean, would people swap driving for flying, for instance? If there's that many more seats available, supply and demand, everything becomes
cheaper.
Well,
it's all price.
And would the prices go down?
Yeah. That's the question. Is the price going to go down?
Can we pay less than $500 to fly somewhere? That'd be nice.
So it could be a good thing for locals as well. I also, David, just have to mention how many wonderful plane nerds there were commenting on the Aspen Time articles about this. I mean, there's like 15 different people like, what about the blah, 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 C7294? Like, people know their planes, and I just got a kick out of that.
Yeah. No, it's an interesting business, the aviation. I have an uncle, a couple of family members who are in the Air Force and then retired and fly planes and do that thing. And it is really, it's an, you know, there's that nerd that in the weeds of, you know, well,
see,
what about this
so
plane and that,
me,
you know, and the power ratio things and the weight to power ratios and the lift. And, you know, it's a very intriguing, very in-depth piece to all of it, you know, and how does that much more wider of a runway and angle differently really make that much of a difference? And it does.
Especially with Aspen. I mean, this is a really unique mountain airport to have it sited where it is. It's really just tucked in the mountains there on the valley floor, and just the nature of the market and the fact that we do have so many direct flights to so many big cities, and that could be expanding. And you know, all those things you mentioned makes it a really there's a lot to chew on there for aviation people.
Curtis, what's your over-under on do I fly out of Aspen or do I drive to Denver and fly out of DIA?
You know, my move is Grand Junction.
Whoa.
Oh.
You must be going
That's
to Phoenix.
Because here's
my thought on that. If it's too snowy to fly out of Aspen, if the weather is bad, the last thing you want to do is be on I-70.
Right.
I-70 to Denver.
And going over two passes.
Right. I-70 to Junction is a cake drive, even if the weather is not good. Mm. So
yeah.
I especially now... we have a little baby flying direct out of Aspen is a huge benefit.
It's
definitely the way we want to go most of the time.
Yeah.
I just don't fly in the wintertime. But mine is usually because I'm debating one now, and is it worth the extra $200 to fly direct out of here versus driving to Denver and staying the night with a friend and then getting to the airport and paying for parking or taking the train.
We did Montrose once last year.
And oh, wow.
Yeah, that actually was
thrown in a curveball.
Going to Florida, and it's not, you know, you go over McClure Pass, but...
Yeah.
Well, I'll say if anyone else that bad. Has a wedding to go to in Portland, Oregon, the first weekend of October, I found tickets for $300 round trip. So I thought that was out of Aspen.
Wow.
I thought it was a score. Yeah.
Yeah, that is a score.
Wow. That's awesome.
So if we can look forward to stuff like that, it's good for locals too, right?
Yeah.
One more big thing before we get to our break here. Another legal battle. The Aspen Wine and Spirits store at this Mill Street station near a radio station here versus Clark's Market, who might be able to start selling real alcohol. Can I call it that? My heart just breaks because they're both local businesses. They both have a really compelling reason to sell a product that makes sense. But Curtis, do you want to start with just filling us in on that lawsuit?
So the way we sell liquor in the state of Colorado is changing. You know, that's one of the things that's really unique about this state is that when you go to the grocery store, you know, there's a case of, you know, there's beer there. But I always warn people when they're buying beer. I'm like, just so you know, it's not real beer.
Just bad flavored water.
It's 3.2% alcohol. It's a, you know, product of prohibition era lawmaking that you can't sell full strength beer in the grocery store or any other type of alcohol. And this has always been, you know, this has been batted around for decades, I think, in the legislature is maybe relaxing those. But problem is, since you can't sell alcohol in the grocery store, there's a whole industry in Colorado that sprung up where next door to every grocery store, there's a liquor store that can sell whatever whatever they want. And there's a bill that passed just recently in the state legislature that will now allow grocery stores to sell full-strength beer, not wine, not liquor,
okay,
but full-strength beer. So
okay,
if you're at the grocery store and you want some beer, you'll be able to get that in one stop without having to go across the parking lot to the liquor store. And the way this is going to work is if you have a license to sell 3.2% beer, you're sort of grandfathered in beginning on January 1 to sell the real deal. And so City Market, for example, has always sold 3.2% beer, so they automatically get the right to do that. What happened here is that Clark's Market, the other grocery store in town, you know, they didn't sell 3.2% beer because why the hell would you do that?
They did until they got rid of the blue laws, and then they didn't. Then they quit selling because with the blue laws, you couldn't buy beer on Sundays, so that was an opening for the grocery stores to be able to have that beer, that liquor licenses. You couldn't go anywhere on a Sunday to get beer.
That's a good point.
So that's why they were able to do that.
I remember the days of buying 3.2% beer on Sunday.
But I think it was 2011 is what Rick wrote, I think, today, was that when Clark's decided not to anymore because
you no longer have that monopoly day.
Right.
Okay. You didn't have that. So why should we give that precious space to that product? But now that this changes with the full strength beer and not near beer, as we called it, is the biggest precipitous, you know, once they got rid of blue laws,
So a lot of this is based on that grandfathered in. Would it be harder for Clark's to, what if they applied in January instead? And it was just straight up, like, we're being honest about it. What we're hoping to do is sell beer, even though this store next to us also sells beer.
Mm-hmm.
Would the license approval process be different? Like, why are they trying to sneak it in before this grandfather?
Yeah, and that's what's interesting about this lawsuit. You know, which is just to be clear, you know, they're suing the Aspen Wine and Spirits is suing the city for approving Clark's 3.2 license, which the city liquor license authority did last month, saying they just didn't really follow the standards that you're supposed to follow here, and that the application wasn't honest in what it was really trying to do.
Well, yeah, it said you couldn't get that product anywhere nearby, which is not true if you think that downstairs is nearby.
Well, yeah, I think what it comes down to it. If we're really talking about whether or not the neighborhood is served by selling full strength beer, I think there's an argument to be held there that, you know, the neighborhood is in fact served by the liquor store next door selling beer. So we'll see what happens.
It's interesting. The process seems to work a little bit differently up here than in Basalt,
where
I live, because the town council voted on that 2 weeks ago, and that was to deny Whole Foods their application to do this very thing.
That's right. What I noticed too, because I remember that was a whole discussion that, you know, people filled the room to support Four right. Dogs against Whole Foods going this route. And the council stood up. They said, these are our local people. We're not going to let the corporations come in and take over. And this was just kind of, we have a separate liquor.
Well, right. It's a separate process. And I think it was under the radar. And we had that thought in the newsroom when we were watching this drama play out in Basalt. Like, well, what's going on in Aspen? Like, yeah. does anybody care? Are these is it basically the same thing happening here as well? And pretty much yes, except it was just happening at the liquor license level instead of the council level. And I don't know, maybe Basalt doesn't have a liquor board and the council just handles that. I'm not.
You know, that could be true. I've never heard of a separate liquor board in Basalt. So
all right, we'll see where that goes.
We're just more efficient.
You are listening to Valley Roundup on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bechtesh. Putting the news of the week into perspective for us today are Cindy Hirschfeld, editor of the Aspen Sojourner magazine, Curtis Wackerly, editor of the Aspen Daily News, and David Krause, editor of the Aspen Times. You can catch links to all of their fine reporting online at aspenpublicradio.org. We'll be back in just a moment. Cindy, the new issue of Aspen Sojourner has been out for about a month now, and there's an article that people are still coming up to you every day and talking to you about that you guys ran in partnership with Ali Margo and Aspen Journalism,
which is Brent Gardner Smith.
The headline is, "How are Aspen's undocumented workers faring in today's political climate?" Why do this story now? What's special now that makes us look at this again?
So I think for a long time, we've had undocumented workers really helping our economy function as it needs to. And Ali had come to me after talking to Brent at Aspen Journalism with his proposal for a story this spring. And the reason we decided to look at it now was in this intense political climate that we have, we wondered, how is that affecting? How is that affecting the economy here? How is it affecting workers? Are workers more fearful? Oh, we didn't even want to make that assumption that they, maybe they weren't.
Yeah.
As we found out, they certainly are. It's a very uncertain climate right now. But it seemed like a timely time to tell the story. And indeed, as Ali was reporting it seemed like things were breaking every day. And that was when the news broke about families being separated at the border and there were different policy changes. And it was really tracking a moving target as she was writing the story.
I want to talk about some of her process, too. And your editors know, you point out, a lot of people wouldn't talk to her at all. Mm-hmm. A lot of people would only talk to her anonymously. What I found interesting was the employers who would only speak anonymously. You know, the workers, I understand. There's employers who are worried about this as well.
Right, because they recognize they have long-term employees who are great workers. They really rely on them. And they don't, as I said in my editor's note, too, it's a really kind of a don't ask, don't tell, and they don't want to lose hardworking members of their staff. They don't want to necessarily, play the role of police and be responsible for having, turning people in. That said, the employers that Ali talked to, they do go through the steps to verify that their employees are, quote unquote, legal, but it's not that hard to, kind of game the system, I guess.
Kudos on that story.
Thank you. Thank you.
It was really well done, and the photos and everything, it was great.
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks. We worked on that project last year with the Glenwood paper, but it was nice to see somebody else take it the next year later and look at how things are continuing to change.
Right,
We ran into that same issue last year when we did our Immigrant and Impact series was, trying to find people to talk and trying to get employees and employers to talk about it. But you just see the dedication of people who work in different industries taking the bus for an hour and a half from Rifle or doing those things. And so it was nice to have that back out in the valley in that conversation again.
Yeah, thank you. And I've gotten comments from a few people about how it doesn't seem like the type of story that necessarily, a resort magazine would publish.
Well, that's what I appreciated the most. Like, let's be very clear about how much we are reliant on immigrants, documented or undocumented, to make this valley run.
Right.
Whether you want to admit it or not, things just wouldn't run here.
And of course, many towns, many restaurants throughout America, you see those same issues. But there was that quote in the story, the Americans who come here they don't want to do this job. They want to ski. Mm-hmm. They want to party. They're hoping that they get paid more, work less. And the people who immigrated here, they came to work. That's why they immigrated, right? So,
right.
So they're here. The one sous chef, who his executive chef said he can do everything I can. He's better at it than I am. I mean, it's heartbreaking, and it's really good to acknowledge that.
Yeah. Right. And no, I should also emphasize, and this is something we talked about during the story too, that we wanted to be careful not to paint everybody with the same brush. And there's enough stuff going on that, you know, certainly didn't want to exacerbate somebody looking at somebody from another country and just assuming, oh, well, they must be illegal. There's certainly a lot of people who are helping economy hum along and are here legally.
Right.
You know, but it's a mixed bag.
So if you haven't read that yet, that is in this issue of Aspen Sojourner.
Right.
David, I'm going to end with you because your column this week, first of all, it's so nice to have you here in one piece in the building because you took a spill on a solo hike. I was summiting Sopra solo the other day and had the same mantra in my head that you open up your piece with. It's stupid to hike alone, and also I love hiking alone.
Right.
And I think the response to that has been almost everyone can relate. Like, that's why we're here, right? We want to get out into the backcountry. We want that peace. We want that one-on-one with nature. And it's kind of dumb.
Yeah, but you can't, you know, on a Tuesday, if you want to go, it's hard to find somebody else to go with you.
Right.
And you want to go when we live here. Mm-hmm. It's great to go on a weekday, mm-hmm. you know. It takes out half of the crowd at least. And when I was on La Plata, I think I counted, because I counted on the way up and down,
okay.
I passed 25 to 30 people.
Yeah.
You know, and so you kind of put that into perspective. But, you know, it just is one of those, you know, we have that page two thing to kind of, you know, let people think about how we use the mountains and how we enjoy the area. And, you know, you think every time, okay, is this good? And like I said in there, you know, you check in when you leave the trailhead. You check in when you get back. You look at the maps. You look at the weather. You get on, you know, I was on the mountain at 5:15 on the trailhead, 5:30 in the morning. And so, you know, everything right, everything
yep.
right. And then that last, you know, mile when you're kind of in the groove and just want to get to the car. And, you know, I still, it's been a couple weeks and I'm still like, I don't know what rock I hit or stepped on mm-hmm. to make my feet go out from underneath me. Then it was on such a ledge that I just rolled to the left and took a tumble, you know. And I've never had one like that. I've done, you know, a few pretty good. I'm not a hardcore hiker. Like I said, I'm not a Cat 4 guy. You know, the twos and threes are fine by me. I like Long's Peak. I like Mount Albert. I like Bierstadt. I like La Plata. But, you know, it just goes to show you that you just can't, even in that last little bit where it's innocuous downhill, you just can't let your guard down.
It tied into Jason's story, too, just looking at that peak awareness program and if that's
right.
worked. And what I didn't realize is how focused that was on front range hikers
right.
coming up to the Elk Mountains, that it wasn't really for all of us, even though clearly all of us also make stupid calls at different times.
Right.
So how has that gone?
Well, you know, here they're not getting the engagement, you know, that they wanted, that they thought they would. But on the front range, they were having classes 40 to 50 people, sometimes maybe 5 or 10. But the statistics show when they put the peak awareness program together that the majority, not the majority, but 50 to 60%. So, yeah, the majority of people coming up to the Elk are coming from the front range. So that's why they wanted to take it down to the REI and take it down to Boulder and the, you know, the Denver places, because they're trying to inform those, you know, the new people to Colorado and the older guard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jason Auslander, who wrote that, is a seasoned hiker, climber. He's done Capitol. He's done, the, you know, some of the harder ones. He's great shape. And while he, you know, went to the class first and then, you know, did the all-day class as well, he did hour and a half instruction. We just wanted to put somebody in there to see what they were telling him. And he said he, you know, learned two or three things,
great.
Not, you know, but he's a more seasoned, but even somebody like that still picked up a few things.
That's
so I think what they're going to do next with trying to get the videos out and trying to take it to people versus having a thing and having people come to them will be a lot more beneficial, especially for people who are here visiting,
sure.
maybe coming from out of town or out of state and flying in and saying, hey, let's go do La Plata and
right.
hope not to slip. But, you know, having him in those courses, I think, helps when you're writing about it, because you can see what they're talking about and what they're how they're doing things. So,
and they are still planning on having some more local workshops going on now in the fall.
Yeah, two or three of the day of the all day classes going as well.
Yeah,
so
yeah, we covered that as well in our midsummer issue.
Right,
took a look at that. So, it's, yeah.
The Ute is for tourists. We only do pyramid.
You've been listening to Valley Roundup on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bechtesh. Thanks to David Krause, editor of the Aspen Times, Curtis Wackerly, editor of the Aspen Daily News, and Cindy Hirschfeld, editor of the Aspen Sojourner Magazine, for putting the news of the week into perspective for us today. It's nice to have you all here.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Allison.
Good to see everybody.
Valley Roundup is a production of Aspen Public Radio News. Mm-hmm.